Have you ever wanted to ask a question but were somewhat apprehensive that the answer wouldn't go the way that you preferred? And when you finally work up the courage to ask the question, then sure enough, the answer wasn't quite what you wanted or even expected. Perhaps you've been flatly turned down where someone said just no. How'd that feel? Were you disappointed or perhaps even discouraged? And I suspect we've all made a request from time to time, and we've gotten turned down. Maybe the answer to our question was no, but it was done in a gentle way, but the answer was still no. And maybe the answer we received was like a shock of a cold splash of water in our face. Or maybe the answer we received was simply quietude. Just quiet, no response at all, not even a tiny peep or a squeak to acknowledge our existence. Same thing as a no, right? So what do you do when you get a negative answer or a negative response? As when you hear the word no, or when you simply don't get a response to your question, you go home and you sit on your hands? Well, today I want to explore how several people of God, recorded throughout the Bible, have responded when they didn't get the answer that they were looking for. And I've entitled this message, Ask, Ask, and Ask Again. That would be Ask, Ask, and Ask Again. When I was a young man in college, my fellow students, the guys in the men's dorm, they would share reasons that they were rejected when asking a young lady for a date. One fellow said his request for a date was rejected because the young lady had to stay home and wash her socks that evening. He kind of got the idea that maybe she wasn't into him. Another fellow, a college mate, said his request for a date was rejected. The young lady said that, or his intended date, she would schedule time to talk to her grandmother that evening. And so, well, that may all be true. It just still puts a shock. And after a while, some guys just gave up asking. Because what? They were afraid of rejection. Well, today, we're going to explore five rules for persistence. Five rules for persistence. And we're going to go through some biblical examples with each one. And I have a list here. The first one is rule one, don't be afraid to ask, but plan carefully. Sometimes you just stumble right into things, right? And then blurt it out and then wonder why you get a rejection. But if you plan carefully, there's hope and opportunity. If we take a look at Esther, the book of Esther in chapter 2, and start in verse 5. In the book of Esther in chapter 2, starting in verse 5. Now, Esther was a member of the tribe of, as I recall, the tribe of Judah that was captured and taken off to a far land. And the king made her his queen, deposed the previous queen. And now this was a girl that grew up as an orphan under her older cousin's tutelage. And her older cousin said, well, they basically had a beauty contest as to who was going to be queen, the new queen. And he said, don't reveal your heritage. Keep your mouth shut and your head down and see what happens. Well, and if we follow through, if we take a look at the history in Esther chapter 2 and verse 5 through 12, we read about how Esther was selected as the new queen and didn't reveal her heritage. We go to verse 14, the last half of the verse. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now, there was a rule. The king, you only entered the king's presence if he called for you. If you came there, what happens if they didn't call for you? That was the death penalty, which is the way the king kept people from rushing him in and asking favor. Verse 15, and Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her, Verse 16, so Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the seventh year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. He had opportunity. He had a huge territory. He was very rich. So he could have whomever he picked, but he wanted Esther more than any other. And as we read on, he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of her predecessor. And he made a great feast, the Feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and proclaimed a holiday, not just in the home country, but in the provinces, their conquered areas as well. That's big stuff. Now, if we go to Esther in chapter 3, we have to enter the king's advisor, who is named Haman. And King Ahasuerus had this advisor, and all kings have their close counsel or their advisors, members of the court, as it were. And as did King Ahasuerus. In Esther 3, in verse 8, then Haman said to the king, "There's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other people. They don't keep the king's laws." Does that sound like anybody we know, any group of people we know that's identifiably different? Well, if people are keeping God's law, do you suppose others would notice this and say, "Hey, wait a minute, those people, they're not like the rest of us pagans over here. There's something about them." So let's take continuing on in Esther verse 8. "Therefore, it is not fitting to let them remain." Verse 9, "If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasury." So, does that sound like a lobbyist promoting a big political contribution? Why, we have that same principle happening today. "I'll provide all of these benefits if only you can write this law to do the way I want it. So what in verse 10? "So the king took his signet ring from the hand and gave it to Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said, 'The money and the people are given to you. Do with them as seems good to you.'" He trusted Haman. "Yeah, sure, just go ahead. These people are going to be a problem. We'll just get rid of them." Verse 13, "And letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, kill, and annihilate the Jews, both young and old, little children and women. In one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, and to plunder their possessions." So there's a prize. You can take everything, you kill them, get rid of them, and then take all their stuff. Well, that's pretty nasty. Verse 14, "A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day." So people could plan ahead. Well, if our neighbor is one of those Jew-type people, we'll dispatch them, and I presume there was some competition as to who was going to get whom first and get their stuff. So in Esther in chapter 4, in verse 4, we have here an explanation of how Esther sends a servant to her cousin Mordecai. This is the man who raised this young lady and said, basically asking, what should I do? You know, we got this. And so she sent one of the servants and to let Mordecai know what was going to happen. And this was critical. And verse 8, "He also gave him a copy of the," meaning a servant, "gave a copy of the written decree for the destruction of the Jews, and that he might command her to go to the king and make a supplication to him and plead him before him for her people. And the servant, returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai." Mordecai said, "Look, if you're serious about saving your people, you're going to have to approach the king. You've got favor with the king. Go ahead and approach the king." And in verse 10, "Esther spoke then to the servant and gave him," in other words, they're using a go-between. The queen just can't actually just go out and walk out past the palace and go do things. It's the same with a lot of people today. If they're an umpty millionaire or a billionaire, they've got security with them. You just can't go everywhere. I know that the only Walton daughter has been to my classroom twice over the last decade. But it was hush-hush, super secret, lots of security, because, you know, somebody who is stands a lot to lose, there are plenty of kooks out there that will threaten somebody. So you have the same situation. They were using an intermediary to go back and forth. And Esther, you know, is responding to Mordecai and says, you know, we got a problem here. Verse 11, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes to the inner court to the king, who has not been called, has but one law, put all to death, except the one that the king holds out his golden scepter. That person may live. So if you got a group of people that are going to go blustering into the king's court, not going to fly in front of King Ahasuerus, they're all going to die unless he holds that scepter, which is about, 18 inches long or so. Usually there's a bejeweled, a golden or silver stick that he, and that person can live. She said, yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So the previous month, she hasn't been summoned by the king. So that puts her at high risk. You just don't go marching into the king and making demands. What did Mordecai answer in verse 13? Do not think in your heart you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's household will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Mordecai was pointing out that you're not going to escape because you're queen, that your relatives are going down, not just, you know, not just your relatives, but you as well. So he put the burden right there on Esther and says, you're in a position to do something. Not everybody else can, but you can, but you have to be willing to make the request. Now, if we turn to Esther chapter 5 and verse 1, and this is explanation in Esther 5 and verse 1, where Esther then requests King Ahasuerus to come to a banquet. Don't we all like to be invited to a party, to a dinner, to a celebration? So in Esther verse 5, what did Esther do? She put on her royal robes. Want to dress up for this one, because she's going to ask the king a question, but she hasn't been summoned. She hasn't been called. She's the queen. After all, he got rid of the previous queen and put her in place. So she knows it's high risk. She could lose her head just that quickly. And so she put on royal robes, stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. She was ready to be noticed. Verse 2, so it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter, accepting his, he offered her to come in. She accepted that. So now we have Esther's first request. And verse 3, and the king said to her, what do you wish, Queen Esther? He knew she was there, unsummoned. So there's a response. He said, she's got to be there for a reason. What do you wish? He said, what is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom, which is an expression by saying it's nearly unlimited. You know, you're in such favor with me. Don't be thinking she would actually get half the kingdom, but that is an expression like, I'll do anything you want. Well, jumping off a high cliff is not really in the picture here. So, verse 4. So Esther answered, here's her request, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman, that's the king's advisor, come today to a banquet that I have prepared for him. Ooh, a banquet for the advisor, the one that wants to kill all the Jews. Verse 7, the king said, bring Haman quickly that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Now, how long do you suppose it takes to prepare a banquet for the biggest empire in the world? Do you suppose it was just one of those McChicken sandwich type of deals, or was there a little bit more involved here? So clearly something was, this was planning ahead, and planning ahead, because she was planning now, first of all, to see if she was going to live or not, right? Just stand there. And of course, most women know that men are visually oriented, and so she put on her best clothes, and the king, you know, flashed a little ankle, and no, he's like every other man, they just fall over and come running. So here we have Esther now in verse 6. She makes a second request. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? It shall be granted you. In other words, what is your request? Up to half the kingdom it shall be done. Verse 7, Esther answered and said, my petition and request is this. If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, which I will do as the king has said, to at this banquet. So now we go to chapter 7 of verse 1. And on the second day at the banquet of wine, these are not small celebrations. Okay? On the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, hey girl, what do you really want? But in ancient Hebrew it was, what's your petition, Queen Esther? In other words, he knew that this wasn't just an offhanded thing because he's familiar with the process. Everybody wants something, right? And he said, it shall be granted to you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom it shall be done. And Queen Esther answered, verse 3, chapter 7, verse 3, if I found favor in your sight, if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. In other words, if it costs me my life, it costs me my life. But I'm kind of hoping that you'll give me my life. Let me live and let my people live. Now referring to her people. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. And verse 5. The king Ahasuerus said to the queen Esther, who is he and where is he and who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing. The king was unaware that this group that was targeting for annihilation was the same ethnicity as his now new queen, with whom he was much pleased. Verse 6, she names who this is. The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. Now, this is a trusted advisor of the king. So now it puts him in a predicament. Like, wait a minute. I have this trusted advisor whom I've given great authority to, and then the queen says, he's the wicked one that's going to destroy my people. In Esther chapter 8, verse 1, this is after the demise of Haman. Or on the route to the demise for Haman, in chapter 8 and verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther told how he was related to her. Now, Mordecai worked at the king's palace, so he was known to the king. So the king, you know, sort of like King Ahab, of the northern tribes of Israel, the head of his household was a guy named Obadiah, the governor of the king's house, and he was a believer. Okay, king didn't even realize it. Well, here we have another king who knew somebody but did not realize that he was a believer. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman at Esther's request, and he gave the signet ring to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. What a turn of events. Here's the guy who had designed the destruction of the people of Judah, which would have included the queen, and turned it over to a Jewish fellow who happened to be the cousin of the queen. Verse 3, and Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman, the scheme of which he had devised against the Jews. Now, here's the problem. The law that the king sent out and put his seal on that Haman devised, their rule was it could never be revoked. Can't repeal it. And so now the king is in a little bit of a predicament if he wants things. So what does she say in chapter 8, verse 4? And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther, and Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it pleases the king, and if I've found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king and am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews, which were in all the king's provinces. She continued, for how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? And so this is a problem now. How is a king going to overcome? Because he can't change the law or the rule. And of course, what he did was he issued one that says, well, I can issue another one that says they can all defend themselves. Ooh, all of a sudden, it's the shoe's on the other foot now. If you're going to go attack the Jews everywhere, well, they have the full right to defend themselves. Well, that's a pretty bold statement with regard to self-defense. And so all of a sudden, people were back on their haunches. Maybe this isn't going to work out quite like they had applied. And then we have chapter 8. Esther asks yet another question. And the king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed. Now, this is after this, after the date where the destruction of the Jews was supposed to happen, and the Jews fought back and won their lives. The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? In other words, we don't know because the word hasn't gotten back yet. So what does the king say? What is your petition? It shall be granted to you. Or what is your further request? It shall be done. So now what does Esther do? She asks yet another one. Now this is pretty bold if you're looking at all these series of questions that she's requesting from the king. She's not afraid to ask the first time, come to a banquet, and then another one, and now to address saving her people. And then she requested, in verse 13, she requested that Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. You say, well, what in the world is that for? Well, that's for the threat of retribution, for the destruction, because Haman was hung on the gallows that were intended for Mordecai. Haman had them built up to hang Mordecai, the Jew, and she said, well, you know, Haman was hung, let his 10 sons, because if you don't wipe them out, we're forever going to have trouble with them. And so what did Esther practice here is, if we take a look at this, at the rule one, was don't be afraid to ask, but plan carefully. She did it strategically, step by step by step. She didn't put it all out at one time. She was afraid to ask, but Mordecai straightened her out on that one, says, don't think you're going to be escaping here. So she planned one thing after another to bring it to closure at the end. So rule one was don't be afraid to ask, but plan carefully, something we can adopt in our lives as well. Rule two, ask with determination. Ask with determination. We turn to Genesis 32 and verse 1. In Genesis 32 and verse 1, here we have a situation. Where in Genesis 32, and Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." And he recognized the name of the place. And we have this verse 24. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now, I've had some bad nights where I didn't get much sleep. I've never wrestled with somebody all night. I think I would remember. And verse 25, now when he saw that he did not prevail, meaning the person who was wrestling, did not prevail against him, the person he was wrestling touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint. And the person Jacob was wrestling said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But he, meaning Jacob, said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Jacob knew there was something supernatural going on here with this event. And verse 27, so he said to him, the one wrestling, said, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Verse 28, "And your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." So this man was sent of God, and that's another issue or another subject we can cover another time. And so it's, and 29, verse 29, Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "What is it that you, why do you ask about my name?" And he blessed them there. Verse 30, so Jacob called the name of the place, Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. So he asked for a blessing. He received his life and blessing. But he wrestled all night, and he had him in a hold. I remember, this was many years ago, I was working for Land O'Lakes as a young man out of college, big company. And I remember the sales manager, Jim Bell. He had a little bit higher-pitched voice, and he says, "Man, when you've got your competitor in a tight grip, don't let loose to get a better hold." Well, and I'm thinking of that as I'm reading over this one, is that he had determination. Overnight, he wrestled all night, and then when this wrestling occurred, he wasn't going to let him know. He says, "No, I'm not letting go unless you bless me." And he did receive the blessing. So he was determined. He wasn't going to let go. So rule two is ask with determination. Rule three, ask repeatedly. Rule three is ask repeatedly. If we turn to Exodus 5, we turn to Exodus 5, starting in verse 1. And here is where Moses entreated Pharaoh 10 times. Now, as you know the story, Moses went before Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go. In Exodus 5:1, afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." And verse 2, Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." That doesn't sound like a very good response. Like people say, we want to go worship God. And he says, "Who is this God? I don't recognize him." And then things got worse. We look in verse 4. The king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you take people from their work? Get back to your labor." Not only are you bothering me, you're interrupting the economy of the nation. Verse 5, Pharaoh said, "Look at the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor? We're just not getting enough work done." Verse 6, so the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, you shall no longer give them straw to make bricks. And he goes on, you know, to keep their quota of making bricks, they're going to have to do even more work in order to do that. Now, the Israelites then blamed Moses and Aaron for even asking Pharaoh to let them go. Just think, if you wouldn't have asked Pharaoh, we wouldn't be burdened with an even greater quota of bricks, and we have to get all of the resources ourselves. So it's a problem. Verse 20. And as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. And they said, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you've made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. The work is going to kill us. And so the people of Israel were very unhappy because Moses was making these outrageous requests, or so they thought, to Pharaoh. Then we look in verse 22. Moses reported to God, saying, hey, I asked, it didn't work. You ever asked something and you didn't see it working? Ouch. So Moses is reporting back in verse 22. Moses returned to the Lord and said, Lord, why have you brought this trouble on the people? Sounds like he's repeating what the people said. Why is it you've sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he, meaning the Pharaoh, has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered your people at all. In other words, hey, I did like you said. We didn't get a positive result, and now things are even worse. We're having a bad day here. And you know the story as we read through the book of Exodus, that Moses and his spokesman Aaron came before Pharaoh 10 times before Pharaoh let the Israelites go. And we can say, well, yeah, that was Moses. The children of Israel were then slaves in Egypt. But my problems are different. I'm insignificant in the world. So why should anyone listen to me, let alone like Moses for the 10 times? But what did Moses do? He didn't stop asking. He asked repeatedly, time after time. And each time Pharaoh said no, bad things happened for Pharaoh. And that's where we have the 10 plagues. So rule 3 is ask repeatedly. Sometimes the first time doesn't do it, or the second, or the third. So now we've covered asking 10 times. Rule 4 is ask yet again. You get the message on this one, that perhaps sometimes 10 times isn't enough. We can look at Luke 18, starting in verse 1, and we have the parable of the persistent widow. The parable in Luke 18, in verse 1, in some translations, it's called the importunate widow. And here it was, there was a judge who feared neither God nor man. We have judges like that today. In fact, they've been like that throughout history. They don't believe in God, and they don't care what man's law said. They're going to just rule however they want. Because after all, they're in charge, right? So we have then... in verse 2, there was a certain judge in a certain city, a judge who did not fear God or regard man. Now, there was a widow in that city, verse 3, and she came to him saying, get justice for me for my adversary. Now, if you're going to expect the judge to rule in your favor, you have to file a petition with the court. That's true today. If you don't ask, you won't get. So, in modern terms, filing a lawsuit means you submit a petition to the court asking the court to give you relief. What do you want done? What do you want the court to do? Is it to prevent somebody from doing something, to force somebody to do something, to collect money for the wrong you've done? Because the court cannot heal a broken bone. The court cannot replace somebody who is lost. But the court can just try to bring equity to the situation. And so here we have the woman pursuing justice, saying, get justice for me. Now, did she have a high-priced law firm from K Street in Washington, D.C., pressing her case? It was just the widow. Verse 4, and he would not for a while. And after a while, afterward, he said to himself, though I do not fear God or regard man, because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Now, I think it's fair to say the judge knew well who she was after so many inquiries that it was starting to bother him. He's going to go to work in the morning, and there she is again. Great. Now I've got to face that one more time. Oh, there she is again. Doesn't say that she was had a saucy tongue. She was being difficult. She was just continually there. And so what does he say? Lest I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Verse 6, and the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said. Shall not God avenge his own elect who cry out to him day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? So you have this, all this questioning that was been done. First, now you have, and you think, well, we've covered it, first three rules. But rule four is ask yet again. You get the idea that you should be persistent, or in this case, about the importunate widow. Rule five is ask, but know when to quit. You know, there's some wisdom that has to crawl into our requesting. We go to Genesis 13 and verse 8. In Genesis 13 and verse 8, and rule 5 is ask, but know when to quit. And this story is about when Abraham bargained with God over Lot's family who were residing in Sodom. In Genesis 13 and verse 8, and Abraham said to Lot, and this is when they separated, Abraham and his nephew Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me, between my herdsmen and yours, for we are brethren, it is not the whole land before you. Please separate from me, and if you take the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I will go to the left. In other words, there's no reason that our herdsmen that watch our flocks and herds should be fighting, as was happening. So, verse 10, and Lot lifted his eyes, saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. The Jordan River was off to the east. And as you know, if you want to, where there's a river, the water is going to be able to irrigate the land around it. And Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east. Verse 12, Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. So you have the separation of Abraham and Lot. And now we go in chapter 18 and verse 16. This is after the angels had visited Abraham and his wife, Sarah. And the visitors had there, they told Sarah she was going to have a child, and she laughed, thought she was much too old for that. And so this was an occasion. And Genesis 18 and verse 16, and the men rose, the ones that were visiting Abraham and Sarah, the men rose from there and looked at Sodom, looked toward Sodom. In other words, that's where they were headed. And Abraham went with them to send them on the way. You ever do that? When you have visitors and they're saying goodbye, you go out to the front porch or you go out to the car and you wave them off. They maybe take pictures, whatever it is the custom in your family. And here it was Abraham seeing them off. Verse 17, and the Lord said, shall I hide Abraham from what I'm doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. And then verse 20, and the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know. So the men turned from there and went toward Sodom. But Abraham stood still before the Lord, and Abraham came near and said, because he knew those angels were going to head over to Sodom and Gomorrah, And he knew they weren't turning their lives around. He said, would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? It's a fair request, right? Wouldn't you ask God, hey, wait a minute. There's some righteous people there. Why would you destroy them? I mean, and he goes on. Suppose there were 50 righteous people in the city. 50 is a small number compared to thousands of residents. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for 50 righteous that were in it? Far be it from me to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you, shall not the judge of all earth do right? He's calling on God to do the right thing and not casually slay the righteous. Verse 26, the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, I will spare all the place for their sake. Well, maybe that gives us hope here in Arkansas, and other places. But verse 27, and then what does Abraham respond? Verse 27, Abraham answered and said, indeed, now I am who I am, but dust and ashes have taken it upon myself to speak before the Lord. He says, I know what I am. I'm just dirt from the ground before you, but I'm going to be brave enough to ask something. Suppose there were 5 less than 50. Would you destroy the city for the lack of 5? So he said, if I find 45, the Lord said, if I find 45, I will not destroy it. And Abraham continues to bargain. Well, what about 40? Oh, I won't destroy it for 40. Get the idea? We're coming down on 50, 45, 40. And then Abraham says, let not the Lord be angry. I will speak. But suppose 30 should be found there. And so the Lord would not destroy it if he found 30 righteous people. Now, did Abraham say, well, that sounds pretty good. Okay. Did he stop there? No, he didn't. Verse 31, indeed, I have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 should be found there. Well, getting the numbers right down there. And he said, the Lord said, I will not destroy it for the sake of 20. Now, Abraham's getting a little touchy here. Okay? And he says, verse 32, let not the Lord be angry, but I will speak but once more. He's putting an end to it. He said, just once more, suppose 10 should be found there. And the Lord said he wouldn't destroy it for the lack if there were 10. And the Lord went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Now, you notice that Abraham was bargaining. He bargained over and over again, but there came a point, and he was pretty concerned on a couple of those, that not the Lord be angry, but here came a time when Abraham recognized it was time to quit. What about us? Do we know when to quit? Do we know when to ask, and ask again and again, and then yet again, but do we know when we quit asking? And this life is given to us to learn how to exercise wisdom, to learn discretion, to be able to ask and ask again, but we have to know when to quit. In Psalm 90, in verse 12, and Psalm 90, in verse 12, we are learning that we have limits. In Psalm 90, verse 12, so teach us to number our days. Be aware that our life has a limit. That, and why? That we may gain a heart of wisdom. We're to learn, gain wisdom in the years that God has given us. And we're in Psalm, let's go to Proverbs 3 in verse 13, and Proverbs 3 in verse 13. In Proverbs 3:13, happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. So we know we have a limited lifetime. And our job is to gain a heart of wisdom. And what does that bring as a side, as a benefit? Happiness, as we get, because we didn't suffer the bad stuff that we are now wise enough to avoid. Well, even non-Christians have discovered the rules of asking. There was an author, some of you may have read his book years ago, and he has on looking out for number one, winning through intimidation, Million Dollar Habits, Robert Ringer. And he has a website, and this was about a decade ago, that I first found that. And he has down the 7 never fail rules of success. And included in that is, don't be afraid to ask. If you don't ask, you don't get. Isn't that the way it is a lot of times? And then by the author of a book written in 1991, it's called The Asian Mind Game. The Asian Mind Game by Chin-Ning Chu. I found that book at Veroman's Bookstore on East Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena in 1991. And that's when I went to work for the Asians that year. And I thought, maybe I better get this book. And it gives the 36 categories of deception. And within each category, there are 6 deceptions in each of those 6. So there's a total of 36 methods of gaining superior control over your adversary. And so I read this book. And for the years that I spent working for Asians and with Asians, they never knew I had this book, because it had all their secrets of negotiating was right there. And so I went through this, but one of the negotiating strategies that they used was quiet. Ignore the question and provide no answer. Give absolutely no information to your adversary whatsoever. And so that was very helpful for me, because I knew the rules of the game, what to do. So I used their own rules to negotiate with them. And they just assumed I was another stupid American. And people wondered, how are you so successful dealing with the Taiwanese, the Chinese, the Koreans, and the Japanese? I read the book. Okay, there was a strategy here on how to ask and how to answer. And so I was able to get information by keeping asking, and sometimes there would be a leak in the dam, just a little bit that would come out. So rule 5 is to ask, but know when to quit. Know your limits. So we're instructed to ask. We can look at Matthew 7. Verses 7 through 12, I'm not going to turn there. But we can look at John 14, verses 13 through 15. And what does Jesus Christ say? Ask in my name. We're instructed to ask. Don't be afraid to ask. Step forward to be able to do that. So if we take a look at a summary, we've looked at rule 1, don't be afraid to ask. But plan carefully. Queen Esther built up courage by repeatedly asking for the king's favor. Rule 2, ask with determination. Jacob wrestled all night and wouldn't let go when he requested a blessing and received that blessing. Rule 3 was to ask repeatedly. Moses entreated Pharaoh 10 times. How many of us have asked 10 times on anything? Rule 4, ask yet again. And that's the example of the importunate widow that bothered the judge continually. Her way of asking was just showing up. Sometimes that's all it takes. Just showing up and being there. And somehow, as it was with that judge, the psychological thorn in the side, that let's get rid of this problem here. Rule 5, ask, but when no one to quit. Abraham bargained with God over Lot's family in Sodom, and he exercised wisdom in knowing when to quit asking. As we know, Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. I couldn't find 10 people. Lot's family fled the city before it was destroyed. Well, we've been given a guidebook on how to approach God and how to approach our fellow man. And we see that guidebook, which is the Bible, helps us to reach the potential that God has given to us. So let us understand when to ask, and ask again, and then rely on God's wisdom and mercy to guide us.